Blog Talk Radio.
Show. My name is Don Allen, and over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, you have some Darth Vader theme going on today.
Felt like I was going to the Solo system, man, you know, with Wabi Ben Kenobi, you know, or whoever. In our spaceship. Kind of that's how the world go around. Don, what we got, man? We on the move. Say, we've got a guest coming on that's going to be talking about some numbers that came out of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department via the Police Conduct Board. I tell you, these numbers will be a shock to our listening audience. I tell you, I just don't know what to do or what to say, Don.
With regards to,
that you know, citizens just aren't being served. I was asking someone the other day, when is the last time the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission actually had a meeting? I mean, you know, a real meeting. And they said they think it's 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow. That's way too long. I mean, even our girl in the background sound effect thinks that's wrong, too. So, but we'll get to that later.
Yes, sir.
And
yes, sir.
Speaking of civil rights, you know, Mr. Edwards, there's a lot of serious challenges coming out of these agencies that are to govern contract compliance, police brutality, reports of injustices and the breaking in civil rights violations by individuals, employers, et cetera. And I'm just, you know, Mr. Edwards, now we talked about this in the programming meeting, MnDOT Falls Short of DBE Goal by Brian Johnson, published June 29th. And I'm looking at it here, and let me get down to the juicy part.
Okay.
From the period of October 2014 through March 2015, DBEs accounted for 6.1% of the federal dollars awarded for state construction contracts. And so as I scan the article a little bit, this will be posted on Our Black News later tonight after the show.
Okay, on your network? Gotcha.
On the network, yeah. And so of the roughly $63 million in federal money spent during the period, $9.9 million went to certified DBE firms. That represents, you know, Black Americans out of 163 million. Okay, that's just an astonishing number for African American firms to get $32,000, which is what the final bottom line cost was.
You must have made a mistake, Don. You must mean 32 million. You must have misread your number.
No.
You were absent a number there.
It's
32, no, Mr. Allen, I have to disagree with my colleague from the right because Kevin Lindsay, the civil rights, human rights commissioner, had said that things are going extremely well, the best it's ever been, and et cetera. You must have been mistaken. Look at it again. Take out a magnifying glass because you must have missed a zero.
I'm going to do that for Mr. Edwards on the right. I'm going to do that. It says the report also broke down the ethnic groups by gender. For example, the 32,741 allocated to Black American businesses involved 3 contracts, all of which was awarded to male-owned businesses. $32,741 out of $1,163 million. That's the unemployment number right there in the Black community. You know, they wonder why, you know, You hear, Mr. Harris, you hear these radio stations, television stations get on the air and say that, unemployment in Minnesota is down. But they don't break down the different communities ever to show that the African-American
Again, Mr. Edwards from the left. I mean, you must have misread that document. You said Minnesota. That document must be a breakdown for the state of Wyoming.
Oh, no, no, sir.
Okay,
no,
where
no,
the
sir,
colored
no,
population, African-American, is about 1.1%. You must have pulled back the wrong document, Donald.
No, no, I am looking at the story published.
This is Minnesota?
This is Minnesota. Commerce and Finance.
Where Kevin Lindsay is the commissioner of the Human Rights, State Human Rights Department, has said that we're not. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I thought maybe we were looking at the wrong numbers. But
an aide has just brought the
document into my studio. Wow.
And this is Minnesota because a gentleman by the name of Lenny Chisholm is quoted, a local advocate for minority contractors, says, one thing MnDOT could do is get more people with business development backgrounds on staff to work through challenges. The business development part is where they struggle, Chisholm said. And Mr. Chisholm has been on this program, Mr. Edwards, several times before talking about the same thing from back 2 years ago where out of, almost a little bit over $60 million, one African-American firm got somewhere around $700. And those documents are actually online. And the MnDOT report is actually online also. But we encourage people to look at that because this is something actually, Mr. Edwards, that the NAACP, Black Lives Matter, and all those jokers that are out there that want to address issues for the African American community, they don't touch this kind of stuff, you know, because their friends are basically running the joint, you know, and so they don't go anywhere near this. And these are the problems, these are the challenges that, you know, back in 2000.
Well, here's the thing, Mr. Allen. I have to remind our listening audience, and again, you from the right, because I'm getting some text messages that are saying Mr. Allen is being just too rough. But I remember a public hearing by the Advisory Committee to the United States Civil Rights Commission back in 2011, and they were talking about the same kind of thing. And I remember a gentleman by the name of Robbie Norman, Mr. Norman, who is the Chief Operations Officer for Tri Construction, which is supposed to be one of the lead African-American minority subcontractors on the site. But in his testimony, he really blasted the state of Minnesota. He blasted the city civil rights department, et cetera. And people said he had gotten crazy just like yours truly kind of thing. So I'm just a little puzzled on why a corrective action hasn't been taken. I mean, there was testimony before the federal government, and must we assume that no one did anything about it other than us?
Well, you know they didn't do anything, Mr. Edwards, because we can look back to the disparity report, City of Minneapolis disparity report, that cost, $500,000 to do, and by NERA, that basically said these are the issues. And they could have gave us that $500,000, and we would have told them the same thing. Because I went downtown again, Mr. Edwards, for like the fifth or sixth time this week, just to drive around and do head counts. And see what type of people were working on these construction jobs in the city of downtown Minneapolis, from Washington Avenue all the way back over to 15th, and from Hennepin all the way up to almost Riverside. And I'm counting, and I counted out of 73 actual construction people that were out on the roads with vests. There were two, what I would identify as African-American, one that I would identify as a Asian-American, and I counted about 8 to 12 women, if I'm not mistaken, if they identify themselves as women. You know, we don't know these days, but that's what I was counting. And so that just made me think even further back to 2008, 2009, when, you know, we were really trying to hammer the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights to get out and do some enforcement and check what was going on, because this good faith effort doesn't seem like it was working at all.
Well, let me just say this, Don. I know for a fact that Council President Barb Johnson has expressed some real concern. She has apparently been asking some questions about how these numbers that are being given by the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department and its different units are certified and authenticated, et cetera. And, it looks like they kind of got themselves caught in a bind, because they could not produce for Council President Johnson any documentation that they've gone out on any site visits and see one of the standards of protocol recommended by the United States government and reinforced by the United States courts. federal courts is that you got to go out and check the sites and verify and actually speak to the warm bodies that, you know, the contractors are saying that they have. You know, a couple years ago, did a piece on a former contract compliance officer by the name of Eddie Calderon, who had been a 34-year employee before Ms. Corvell fired him. At the same time, she pushed out the late Corky Taylor. People don't like to talk about that because Corky was, you know, good friends with a lot of the important people. But there are documents which shows Mr. Calderon being told that he was to accept whatever numbers the general contractor and developer gave him. And Council President Barb Johnson has said that that's unacceptable. And yet when she has asked the Civil Rights Department to confirm that that they are doing site visits and et cetera, they just lie. You know, I don't know what we can do. I don't know. Maybe Mayor Betsy Hodges can empanel a citizens panel to examine. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, Ms. Evans, what really strikes me, and no disrespect to the mayor or her wonderful husband at all, but, I mean, we were in the city council chambers when NERA released their finding, and at the time, Councilwoman Hodges sat there with
kind of nonchalant look. That was on the morning of October 26, 2010. Yeah. October 26, 2010,
sitting
there.
And she really didn't say too much, you know, and I noticed that after she won the, won mayor for Minneapolis, she started having these little conferences talking about equity. And, you know, it was always my, one day, if I ever see her, I'm going to ask her, I'm saying, you know, what's the difference between equity and fairness? Can you explain that to me? Can you just, I don't understand. I don't understand at all. So,
yeah, well, that would be a good question, and I'm quite sure the city civil rights director, who's making probably about $122,000, and her deputy, the legendary Michael Kip Brown, I think he makes around $118,000 or thereabouts. I'm quite sure they can answer those questions because they are the protectors and defenders of the statutes and ordinances of the city of Minneapolis. Now, who is the defender other than Kevin Lindsay? Who is the defender in MnDOT? We talked about MnDOT, and we have to remember we have a caller holding. Who is the protector and defender? Wasn't there a woman, a Caucasian woman who was there, Mary somebody who was
Mary
pushed
Prescott.
Out? I understand she's now back.
Actually, Ms. Eric, that's funny that you bring that up because I remember in detail Mary Prescott was actually pushed out, received a raise, got to work at an office that was 3 minutes from her home, And this is after MnDOT consistently failing. I know that we met with her on several occasions, and she point blank asked you in the meeting, Mr. Edwards, because you were there, of course, how do you do civil rights? You know, with set
off
alarm.
She did. She wasn't around much longer after that, but she sure did. She sure did. Mm-hmm. But I understand they retooled her, dusted her off, and she's on her way back in.
Yeah, well, you know, right now they also have a young lady by the name of Kim Collins, legally trained at one of my universities, at Hamlin University, and I spoke with her today, and we're going to attempt, we have a tentative agreement with her to come on the air on the 15th of this month. This is 2 Wednesdays from now because, you know, we want to find out and have some teachable moments about MnDOT and its consistent flukes and wobbles. And
you know, maybe we can be joined by the legendary civil rights activist and entrepreneur, Mr. Louis King, who on a couple of programs over the last couple of years indicated that he put his boot, on the rear end of MnDOT and got them straightened around. And, in fact, it came on the heels of the battle during the building and the construction of the Loring Bridge over the Mississippi River there and north, linking up North Minneapolis and Northeast. So, anyways, hopefully we can get Lewis to come in and we can have the protector, if you will, and enforcer of the diversity civil rights policies of the MnDOT. And maybe at some point we'll be able to ask the commissioner to respond to what his representative says to us on the 15th of July.
Yeah, be really wonderful. Just be a great thing to have. And
okay.
I'm going to also try to invite the commissioner. And, Mr. Edwards, we do have two guests now in the queue holding, ready to come on at your hourly convenience. Should we move to that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, we're having tonight to have, and I'll get it right this time, Ms. Gross, Citizens United Against Police
Community
Brutality.
Community
United. Community, okay. Well, there we go. United, yes. And Communities United. And then we also have Sir Dave. And Dave, how do you pronounce your last name again? I'm sorry, I didn't write it down. Binking?
Sorry, Dave Binking.
Okay, Dave Binking online here with us to talk about what's going on. And, Mr. Edwards, I'm going to hand it to you.
All right, then. Thank you, Ms. Down. Yes. And welcome to both of our guests. And I'm going to start with Ms. Gross, and she can bring David in at what point that she feels there's additional information. But the latest situation was drawn to my attention, and I have to commend Ms. Gross and her associates when they forced the city of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department to post the numbers of the, first of all, the number of complaints that had been generated with the, or filed with the police conduct board, if you will, or whatever, also in that included the name and certainly the address and the status, Mr. Allen, of the case, if you will, 1,000 cases. And so, you know, when we were talking with Ms. Gross, and she was talking about the numbers. Initially, we thought that Reggie Chapman of WCCO was going to be doing a story on this either yesterday or today. That has not happened yet. But I asked Ms. Gross, what was the number? I was expecting that out of 1,000 complaints, and I am reasonably close to the whole issue of public safety here in our city, as you know and we know, as a federal monitor. And so I just kind of threw out a number like 200, 300, and I was just floored because the numbers now seem consistent with a corrective action that had to be taken by the federal government based on documentation that was being provided by the Civil Rights Department and specifically Mr. Michael Kip Brown, recognized civil rights expert and public safety expert. So, Ms. Gross, can you explain to us what the heck happened and how they came up with a grand total of 2 out of 1,000? And welcome.
Well, thank you. First of all, thanks for having me on the phone on the show, and I am eager to have people hear about this situation because it's really quite appalling. So there's, you know, our organization for a very long time now has been tracking the way that the city handles complaints against police and whether they do a good job or not. And this is all the way back to the days of the Civilian Review Authority and all the way to the present. And when they when the city killed off the Civilian Review Authority and brought on this other agency that is not really any kind of civilian oversight, it's really the police with a little tiny smattering of members of the public thrown in for kind of some legitimacy, even though it shouldn't be considered very legitimate. You know, we knew then we'd really have to watch these people. So we had put in a data practice request, you know, under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act.
Could you do this for our listening audiences, both international and domestically? Could you give us dates as you talk in terms of the request that you made? What was the date?
Yes. We submitted a request on May 8th. And the city, under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, they're required to quickly, you know, in a reasonable time period, return that data to us. And that meant that they should have given it to us by, you know, the third week in, roughly the third week of May. Well, we didn't get this data until last week, and that was after bugging the wits out of them to get them to give it to us. You know, they tried their level best to avoid giving it to us. And the reason I feel strongly about that is that they were aware, you know, both from our appearance on your previous show, as well as us, you know, going to meetings and raising this issue, they were aware that we knew that the numbers that they were putting out were just plain false, that they were cooking the book. And so, you know, I wanted to keep us from getting the actual hard data that would show that. And so, you know, so sure enough, we finally got the data last week, and sure enough, it is true that they, you know, were trying to give their work a much rosier appearance than it actually is. And so the numbers are cooked, to be sure, and the real numbers are quite, you know, bad by comparison, even though the other numbers were pretty bad already, but these are really appalling. And we'll get into that in, you know, kind of just a second. But then something really interesting happened. Part of the Data Practices Act says, you know, you can find out about the complaints, you can know about their existence, their status, you can know the name and badge number of the officer, and you get to know the name and contact information of the, you know, complainant, right? And we've never used that in any way except to, you know, like I said, we've used the documentation to help us study what's going on with the handling of these complaints, and we've never, you know, use this, and first of all, we would never expose the name and contact information of complainants because that would just be wrong and might even lead to retaliation against them, so we would never do that. But then the city does something very interesting. I learned on Monday, by virtue of the fact that I began to get just dozens of telephone calls to my cell phone, my personal cell phone, you know.
Your personal cell phone or your organization's phone? I'm sorry.
My personal cell phone.
Oh.
I began getting all of these telephone calls to my cell phone saying, I got a letter from this, you know, I got a letter from your organization, or, you know, people were just like, what's this letter about? And I didn't know what they were talking about. I got on the phone with a couple of these folks and said, could you read me the letter? Turns out the city of Minneapolis sent out a letter telling people we had to give these people over there, that group, your data. And on the letter, they then copied our initial request on the back of their letter when they sent it out. And all
right.
These people thought that they were getting a letter from us. And it, like I said, it contained my personal email address and my personal cell phone number.
Mm-hmm.
And this was crazy. So, I mean, overall, I've probably gotten maybe 75, 80 phone calls from people at this point. Every day I'm getting more and more phone calls. Just,
okay.
You know, of people going, what are you doing with my data? What is this? You know, why did you send me this letter? And I'm trying to explain to people, no, this is something the city sent. Now, it's odd for this reason. I've been getting this kind of data from the city for like 22 years. I have never had them send a letter to people saying, you know, we get to give these people your data, blah, blah, blah. You know, they have no legal obligation under the Data Practices Act to notify people that they're giving government data, that's public data, to us. They've never had any obligation to do that. They've never done it before. I've gotten, you know, hundreds of files from Internal Affairs, hundreds of files from the Civilian Review Authority. They've never sent this kind of letters out before. So it's
Let me ask a question about the physical letter. I want to be absolutely clear for our listening audience domestically and internationally, because this is a big municipality, big government, big money. Was I correct in hearing you say that they sent out a letter to 1,000 people and they just they copied on both sides of the letter as opposed to making it a 2 or 3 page professional type letter? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. They put their letter on the front, and they put ours on the back, and then they stuck in an envelope in such a way that ours was the first thing that people saw. So all these people assumed that we had sent them that letter. It's a strange thing.
You are absolutely correct, because I will not identify the individual, but I received a call from a person that is one of those 1,000, and they said something interesting, because also in the letter was something that said additional information contained within. And there wasn't anything else in the envelope. But
except us, you know, yeah.
Right. Yeah, but this letter. So let me get it right again. So on one side was the letter by Michael Kip Brown's and his group indicating that you were asking for information pertaining to the case that had been brought to their attention under color of law. And then on the back or front, I guess, you know, we can battle over that, was your letter under the Minnesota Data Privacy Act formally requesting, I think you gave them actually until the 15th of May in your
correct.
Letter, that that they
correct.
Should be able to respond by the 15th. Am I correct? Am I talking about the same letter?
I think we gave them to the 18th. We gave them until
okay.
the 18th.
Now,
yeah.
the question that was posed to me is, why did you have this particular complainant's information? And I've had to explain that you didn't have the information. You did not seek any information. You merely sought to identify the numbers of people that had filed complaints under color of law. And the key element, I thought, legally was what was the name and what was the disposition of the case. Is that basically correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much the deal. Now, again, under the Data Practices Act, there's certain elements that they have to give you for any complaint against police officers, and those elements are actually spelled out in the government, you know, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, and it's the existence of the complaint, the status of the complaint, the badge number and name of the police officer, the name and contact information of the complainants. So
okay,
and then,
now that seems to be as clear as possible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, and then if the complaint is sustained and disciplined, they also have to tell you that and tell you the chief's action. So that, like, what the discipline was and what was the allegation that brought about that discipline.
Okay, let me ask this question. I hear Dave trying to get in. But I need to ask this question for the purpose of the sense of constitutional protection. At no point did you make any requests for all information pertaining to the complaint, the investigation, and the determination. Is this correct, Ms. Groth?
No, we did ask for that information. We wanted the complaint. We wanted all the data that was available to us about a complaint under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. We asked for that data, but that didn't mean that, you know, that they needed to say, hey, we gave these people your data. You know, there wasn't any reason for them to say that.
Right.
All right.
You
now
know,
let me then go to the calls that you received also from individuals, and I'm really trying to get a feel. Mr. Allen, my colleague who I've talked to about this in our production meeting, and I know certainly Dave is well-versed, you had calls from people who told you that they were told, maybe 30, 35 people, that they were told by Mr. Brown's office that their case could be reopened. Was that something that they would like to have done? And I was puzzled by that because there is no statutory there does not exist statutorily any way, shape, form, or fashion that once a determination is made that there is the right of appeal or reversal. So, I mean, what was that about, Ms. Groth?
Well, that's the funny part. You know, we began to talk to these people, and here's the thing. You know, in my opinion, and I don't have proof of this, of course, but in my opinion and belief, I believe that the reason that they sent out this letter was really essentially retaliation. You know, we're going to have all these people bothering these people with this group, and this group is all volunteers and blah, blah, blah. But it's backfiring on them because all these people are calling us and they're saying, I am so upset. The city just blew me off. You know, they didn't do anything with my complaint, blah, blah, blah. And I'm able to say, yeah, that's true. They didn't do anything with your complaint, and they did blow you off. And then I get to say, but you know what? There are things you can do about this and get to talk about that with these people. So I'm getting to talk to an awful lot of very lovely people in the city of Minneapolis and even people outside of Minneapolis that came into Minneapolis and had things happen to them. And so it's kind of funny for us. We're actually laughing about it because it turns out that the city's actually recruiting people for us, which is, you know, sort of bizarre, right? You know,
right.
It's one of the strangest things I've ever had happen.
Let me do this, though, for purpose again of our listening audience, because we started out this interview with you by saying that of the 1,000 complaints filed over a 2.5-year period, according to the documents they ultimately gave you, only 2 cases were sustained. And could you explain, you know, to the general audience what sustained means?
Well, a few more cases than two were sustained, but only two were actually disciplined, meaning that there was probably a handful, and Dave has actually got the number, so I'm going to ask him to come on in just a second. Only a very small handful, less than a dozen, were sustained, but of all of the cases in 2.5 years, which is near 1,000 cases, two have been disciplined in 2.5 years.
Right.
So, Dave, Dave, you should talk about this a little bit more because you've got the exact numbers.
Right.
Yes, give us
right.
the numbers, Dave. Talk to us.
Sure.
Tell us what it means so that our listening audience is as knowledgeable as possible in this situation.
Certainly. This is a chance for people to file a complaint against a police officer, a civilian, as opposed to someone inside the police department. And there have been, they say, 962, and it looks from our data that it was 962 cases that were filed during this 2.5 years. A large number of them were thrown out very quickly with very little review. But in the end, there a few cases went to a panel, and a few cases were found to have merit. And
Let me just stop
right.
you. A panel consists and is structured of whom?
The panel has two civilians on it, appointed by the mayor and the city council, and it has two high-ranking police officers. So it's half and half civilian and police, but any ties are broken by the police chief, essentially. So as opposed to back when we had a civilian review authority, when the panels that made the final decisions on the cases or the final recommendations, at least, those panels were made up entirely of civilians, and the investigators were civilians. Here we have two civilian investigators and seven sworn officers who are investigators. And as I say, the panels, which very few cases go to.
Now, wait, let me cut it again. The seven, the
right.
number seven of police officers that you gave, that is
right.
because there is a joint investigative effort by the
right.
Oversight Committee and by the Police Department's Internal Affairs Unit. Is that correct?
That's right. Basically, they have merged something kind of like the old Civilian Review Authority, just merged it right in with the Internal Affairs Unit. But the Internal Affairs Unit has seven investigators and only two civilian investigators. So you know who's dominating in this outfit. And,
okay. All right. I cut
yeah.
you off at the panel. All right. So the panel
sure.
the panel hears the complaint and, of course,
right.
Hears the evidence. Go on from there, please,
right.
sir.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then they make a recommendation as to whether the complaint has merit, that it should be that there should be some discipline. Not many cases get to that point. Somewhere around maybe a dozen total in this whole time. And then
Dave, can you step back for a second? Here's the thing, Ron. Before you get to the point of any cases going to this panel, there's
mm-hmm.
like three other levels that these cases go through where it's all city staff. So almost, I mean, at most, this panel is listening to one case a month. I mean, at most. They hardly any cases even get to a panel. Most of them get thrown out well before that stage.
Right.
Now,
let me
ask the question,
so
then, but both you and Dave, either one can answer.
Cases.
Who has the statutory authority to throw a case out before it goes to a hearing panel?
Well, it gets disposed of in a number of different ways.
Please explain to us.
It can be dismissed by the two supervisors, one civilian and one police, of the unit, and there is some real question as to whether they have the statutory authority to do that. There are certain things, like, for instance, if it turns out the police officer wasn't a Minneapolis police officer, they have the authority to do that. They've been tossing a number of cases just because they don't think there's enough evidence. There's some serious question as to whether the statute actually allows that. A large number of the cases that don't get thrown out just right away go to the precincts for possible coaching. These are supposed to be low-level violations, but we've documented that some much higher-level violations have gone through that process.
Okay,
point,
so
the
process has
look at it. Right.
The cases detouring from what started
right.
out as citizens coming to the city hall, going up to
right.
either the Civil Rights Department or the Police Internal Affairs Unit, But there's a detour, okay, because the cases can be referred back down to the precinct. Is that right? Okay.
Right.
And so what happens after that?
Right. That's happening to at least a quarter of the cases. The officer's supervisor does their own investigation, and they aren't really an investigator, and we don't know how many people they're talking to and how much they do. And then the supervisor can decide whether the officer is even coached. So 216 cases went to the precinct. Only 83 of those, you know, less about a third, actually wound up with the supervisor sitting down with the officer for coaching. But much more important, only 20 of those cases out of the 216 did the supervisor decide that the officer had actually done anything wrong. In the other cases where he sits down with him, he says that, you know, you didn't do anything wrong, but, you know, maybe to help avoid complaints in the future, maybe you could do this or that. Of course, all of this happens in secret. We have no idea.
I'm sorry. I have to cut in on that as a federal monitor. You said it's done in secret? I mean, how so?
Oh, absolutely, right. The coaching, there is no one there in that room except the supervisor and the officer involved. They have to fill out some documentation afterwards, but we don't know what happens in that room. So there's no guarantee that the officer is actually
being
reprimanded in any way at all.
That could be a video guy just coming hot again. You know what I'm saying? A whole lot of that could be, a whole lot of this could be, hey, buddy, you know, way to go, but just don't get caught doing it again.
Okay.
You know,
let me move back to a question, because I know of the rights that officers say they have. Are these coaching procedures, is there a kept record? In other words, are they recorded?
No, the coaching itself is not tape recorded. No.
To the best of your knowledge, what does the statute say on that?
Happened, but that's it.
Well, excuse me, Dave. What does the statute say on the issue of confidentiality?
Right. It doesn't say anything, but in practice, it is totally confidential. And because it is something that's, you know, a personnel matter, personnel matters are generally private, except for when there is some actual discipline. And coaching is not, under the law, considered discipline. So if it goes to coaching, there is no record, there is no public information about how the case proceeded or what the nature of the offense was or anything whatsoever.
Okay, let's move
further.
On to, let's say that the coaching doesn't work, what then does the statute require of the municipality?
If the coaching doesn't work, it doesn't work. Nobody goes back and looks at it or anything else like that later, unless another complaint is filed against the same officer.
I see.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so there's no follow-up on that to determine whether the officer is actually doing a better job or not, unless someone happens to file a complaint. And you know darn well that there isn't one case in 20 of misconduct by an officer that actually leads to a civilian saying, I'm going to go down and file a complaint about this. Most people aren't going to do that because they're worried about doing it or they got too many other things in their day. And remember, filing a complaint doesn't do anything for the person who files it other than a sense of, I hope this never happens to anyone else again.
All right. Walk us through those two cases that there was actually, according to what Ms. Grohl said, there was actually a disciplinary action taken. How did those two cases get that far out of 970?
Those are cases that were found to have merit. They went to the police chief, and the police chief decided that there should be some discipline. And there have been, you know, I think we know that at maximum of 8 cases are 8 officers where the police chief has decided there should be discipline. Once the chief decides that, then the case can be grieved by the officer.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been trying for a year or more to find out, so what happens in the grievance process? Is anybody actually getting disciplined, or does it go to a grievance and get overturned? And finally, with this data, we now know that 2 officers have actually received discipline. One of them got a 3-week unpaid suspension. The other one got a 2-week unpaid suspension. And that is the sum total of the discipline that's happened. as the result of 2.5 years, almost 1,000 complaints, 9 investigators working full-time plus a bunch of staff, and 2 officers who received discipline. And what's most remarkable, of those 2 officers, the one that got the 3 weeks unpaid suspension, the highest discipline anybody's gotten as a result of this process, that officer, the complaint, came from a police officer from a different jurisdiction. It didn't actually even come from a civilian. So we can say, as far as civilians, people like you and me filing a complaint against a police officer in Minneapolis, one officer has gotten 2 weeks off without pay, and that is the sum total of 2.5 years work by at least.
Okay, now that 3 week suspension without pay, was that the case of a Minneapolis officer being involved in a stop by a Wisconsin law enforcement officer in a confrontation?
Exactly, yes. Stopped in a car that he wasn't supposed to be driving. He was speeding, and he mouthed off to the Wisconsin officer, and the Wisconsin officer certainly considered it to be a threat as well as just the foul language, yes.
Okay.
So, yep.
And could you share with us the 2 week suspension? What was that?
We don't know the details of that case yet. Wait a minute.
I have to, on behalf of the civil rights board. I mean, Mr. Brown is not prepared to make that information known to you?
He has to make that information known. Once we know that a case has received discipline, then we can get the file, and we made that request back a few days ago for that file. Now, they have it right at their fingers and copied in a day, but we don't expect that we're going to get it very soon. But, yes, they have to give us that file. But, no, it isn't like we can ask Mr. Brown, and he'll say, well, sure, here, I'll send somebody to the copy machine and get you that information that you deserve. No,
okay.
I mean,
how much is his operation and department, how much are they allowed to redact?
Once there is actually discipline imposed, they can redact information about confidential informants. They can redact and have to redact medical information. For instance, if the person was injured in their hospital records, that's a person's private medical information is redacted. That's pretty much the only, or if there's information about a juvenile, that would be redacted. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we get to see all the interviews and process in the case. And we're looking forward to seeing that in these 2 cases. But as I say, no, it's never easy to get this information even when we're entitled to it.
All right. Mr. Allen, do you have any questions? Are you still there with us? Do you have any questions?
I'm sorry, I'm just here with that. I was screening some calls in the queue.
Yes, I know, man.
No,
you got a lot of texts.
Yeah,
any specific questions as we begin to wrap? Because this has been, in depth once again by Ms. Gross and Dave. In fact, the last time they were on with us, it generated a conversation and a call in from the chairman of the powerful Public Safety Committee, Congressman Yang. Anything else, Michelle, Dave? Anything else that you feel the public needs to know
about
this
process?
If you could call it that.
You first, Dave, and then I want to talk.
we did get the contact information of the people who filed complaints. And that's important. It's not that we want to publicize that all over the place and violate any confidentiality of theirs. But without that contact data, neither we nor anyone can go back and ask the people who filed complaints, what was your experience? And with any kind of program like this, it's very important to survey people who are actually participating or being served by it to find out, were you treated well? Were you satisfied with the outcome? Were you satisfied with the process? And unless we can get that contact information, we can't find that out, and nobody in the public can find
that
out.
Well, I'm going
to
tell you what I'm
going to
do over the air. I'm going to do this. I am certainly going to authorize that you may ask about my situation and the situation of 8 other African Americans who were put on the floor at the Elks Benevolent Organization a couple years ago, and shotguns were put to our heads. We thought our middle name and our whole name was NIG and et cetera. I would, at some point, Ms. Gross, if you ever have some kind of public hearing, I would be most happy to tell you about the experience of what happened,
including
the investigation.
That's the interesting part. part of what we are going to do with this information is we are going to invite these people who have gone through this process to come to a listening session, and we'll have a real listening session, not the kind of listening sessions the city usually has that really mean shut up and we'll talk. We're going to have actual sessions where people that come can get to tell their experiences. The other thing, you started going down the road, and I wanted to just go back to this for a second, Mr. Edwards, if that's okay. As I began to talk to all of these people, and they began to express how upset they were with the process and how they felt like their complaint was just thrown out summarily and all this, a few of them began to say, but I just got contacted by the Civil Rights Department, at, by this agency, this OPCR, Office of Police Conduct Review, to ask me if I wanted to have my case looked into again. And I thought that was tremendously interesting, because it's as if, they said, oop, those people have got the goods on us, so we're going to go back and see if we can work some of these cases now and undo what we've already done. And then, as you pointed out, there is no statutory authority to do this. It just seems like it's a kind of a face-saving mechanism.
Well, let me say on behalf of the monitors, the federal government, based on corrective actions that had to be taken with regards to the numbers of Mr. Brown's operation, the federal government has warned the city of Minneapolis about continued breaches of procedure, statutes, and constitutional law. So I'll just share that with you over the air.
Good.
Wow.
And that,
wow.
That
be watched.
That is a serious constitutional and material breach. To make those calls and suggest to people that their cases could be reopened. I would like to see Ms. Velma Corvell, who Mr. Brown reports to, and I'd like to see both of them who have to report to Councilman Yang and Council President Barb Johnson sits on the Public Safety Committee. I'd like to see them explain to those council members how that kind of offer was made.
Yeah. It's darned interesting.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Right.
It's almost like they got their hands caught in the cookie jar, and now they're trying to figure out how to get themselves out of it.
Right.
They thought they were going to be smart Alex, and send out this letter to all these people and, cause people to be angry with us. People are not angry with us. People are so glad to hear from us. They don't even know what to do. They're calling us, and they're saying, hey, when are your meetings? Can I come? It is like the city of Minneapolis. Our organization is a small organization. We're all volunteers, and we have very little money, very little resources. We wouldn't have had money to send letters out to 1,000 people, right? But
no.
It's as if
right.
It's as if the city is recruiting for us, and I've never laughed so hard in my life. I love it.
Yep.
All right,
yep.
All right. Anything else, Dave? Do you have anything quickly?
That's fine. It's just wonderful that we're hearing from these people and getting exactly the kind of information that we need to know and the people in Minneapolis need to know about how people are really being treated who file complaints. Yep.
All right. Mr. Allen and myself wish to thank both of you again for taking the time to come on the air and talk about this latest development. And again, Ms. Gross, in that you are the founder and head of the organization, I just want to commend you for doing something that a whole lot of big organizations, well-financed, should have done from the get-go. Okay?
Right.
Well, thank you so much.
And our city council members and the mayor and everybody else should have been watching. Yes. Thank you very
much. All right.
Yes.
Thank you, and we'll be talking again. All right. Yeah, Mr. Allen, what are we going hour, half, hour and a half? What are we doing tonight?
We're going to 10, sir.
All right, then.
Yeah.
Your observations, Mr. Allen. You had me examine and said, what is your observation?
Well, I'm seeing something that the Minneapolis Civil Rights has done on several occasions, is trying to get people, pit people against one another. And we know, from Shredgate of 2011, when they shredded all those files of the complaint, to this, it just seems like some more mix-up down there, and they really don't want anybody to do civil rights the way that civil rights should be done in the department like that. And I'm still, befuddled, Mr. Edwards, of why Michael Kip Brown and Velma Corbell would make the decision to say, hey, these people are asking for your information, your private or personal, or however the letters were worded to these individuals. That sends out a false hope. That makes anxiety. That creates a really bad atmosphere between Michelle Gross's group and the city and the individuals that went down to the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights and got nothing, as you did, as I did before, and a lot of people have done.
Right.
Okay, we've all had just terrible, ugly experiences where they just don't do what they need to do. And it's heinous, the malfeasance that goes on in that department. So, I mean, at what choice? I mean, we're going to have to definitely look at the city council, the mayor, the public safety committee to do something immediately about Velma Corbell and Michael Kirk Brown. I was there, Mr. Edwards. I think you were, too, the day that, you know, they were, like, acknowledging her being the head of the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, and I put the video up online. And she said, I'm going to do all these great things and blah, 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 after Michael Jordan left, and seemed to just go further down in the trenches for everybody.
Yes, and what Ms. Gross and her organization have brought forward should be of concern, starting with the mayor and then the full council, if you will, as well as the federal government, who is monitoring closely what is going on here, and were of the opinion that the process was improving. But I'm aware, having been in a meeting in which, I didn't want to talk to Ms. Gross about it. I actually had Michael Kidd Brown tell me that Ms. Gross and her organization had never raised any questions about the accuracy, the integrity of the data and the information. And I just, I wasn't stunned or taken back because I've watched this man operate before, but it was fascinating to hear him be that bold. And this is a man who is looking for an appointment to the district court bench. Oops. And it's just unbelievable how he had been bad-mouthing Ms. Gross and her organization. He forgot that WCCO had done an interview with her back in the early spring, in which she said a lot of what she just got through saying on this program and said on a prior program when she was with us here about a month ago, a month and a half ago. And it was just fascinating to hear the head of this powerful entity, the Police Conduct Board, just indicate that not only were they happy and satisfied, but if they had any concerns, they didn't have legitimacy to make those concerns public. It was a fascinating meeting. Took place right in City Hall. Yeah. But anyways, phone lines are open. We haven't said that. Phone lines are open. We're going until 10. We've just had a couple conversations. Number one, Mr. Allen has brought forward some very interesting information about the continued ups. Here we go again, Don. Pattern and practice, if you will, P&P, in which, once again, African Americans are being denied economic inclusion, opportunity, even the chance for success, and et cetera. And now we've spent almost a half hour with Ms. Gross and her advocacy organization revealing what they uncovered after they had to go to the state of Minnesota and act under the Freedom of Information data practices, if you will, and discovered some numbers and some conditions and et cetera that should be disturbing. You know what I'm saying, Don?
Yes, I agree 100%.
Okay. So the phone lines are open. Any observations or concerns people may have? By the way, we also want to do this. This also comes at a time we're on the national scene. You know, we're not through with Charleston. We haven't forgotten about it. Don, I'm extremely disturbed at the outbreak, the sudden outbreak since the 21st of June, the burning of black churches in the South.
Ms. Edwards?
Yes.
Oh, we have a caller?
Let's get the caller in.
Okay. Call your live on air. Go ahead.
Oh, gentlemen, thank you very much. This is Mr. M.
M, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. You know, very riveting program, as always. I'm sitting in my palatial estate, enjoying your program, and I'm not letting anybody know where my palatial estate is.
Got you, sir.
But, you know, as you talked about the Minneapolis civil rights, you know, I want to go back. You know, I know, Mr. Edwards, you go back to a time, well, you predate me. I mean, I'm, and that's not a negative or positive. That's just reality, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there's a good friend of mine that I grew up with, I mean, that I knew very well. His name was Kenneth White, okay?
Yes, sir. Former director of the Civil Rights Department in the 1990s.
Former director, mm-hmm. former director, and he was really, we were really on the, this was a continuum of the Harry Davis days of the, you know, and keeping this city so that, you know, the African American had a foothold in this city that we deserved. Okay.
That's right. The days of the Urban Coalition, the Urban League, NAACP.
Oh, Urban League, Urban Coalition. Oh,
go right ahead, sir.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was. But then, you know, unfortunately, you know, they ran him out of there
mm-hmm.
on some trumped-up charges, something about he had a relative hired. Well, you know, I know the relative that he hired because the
mm-hmm.
relative, I recruited this person, and this person had an advanced degree.
mm-hmm.
And he was hired to do a job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just because he happens to be a relative, he went through the civil service process. But my point is, the Minneapolis,
civil service,
those agencies, human mm-hmm. rights, those agencies have been just totally neutered. You know, those agencies used to have some clout. I mean, I don't know who's on the civil rights. I mean, does it exist anymore?
We said at the top of the program, if you weren't with us, Mr. Allen and I were making fun, if you will, and I pointed out that our review for the last year or so of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, which I certainly have a most significant interest and stake in, going back 40 years, 50 years, has really not had a public hearing on anything. This is the honest to God truth in almost 10 years. In almost 10 years.
You know, that's pathetic. It wasn't there also. There used to be something when I used to work over at the St. Paul at the Metro Square building. There was a State Department of Human Rights.
That's correct.
Oops.
That is under Kevin Lindsay, who is
yes.
the commissioner of the State Department of Human Rights. And then, of course, you have the St. Paul Human Rights Department, which is the equivalency of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. They're both statutorily the same. We have those three entities right here in the metropolitan area.
But I hear nothing from them anymore. I mean, are they defunct? Are they there? Are there still bodies of people
yes,
that are
yes,
supposed
yes. They,
to be
they still draw
following
checks.
Their mission?
Yes. Now, I really couldn't tell you. You know, I pride myself on being on top of these things, but I couldn't really tell you who the director of the St. Paul Civil Human Rights Department is at this hour.
Well, you make my point. you make my point. Now, wasn't there a gentleman by the name of, at some point, a Michael Jordan? Wasn't he?
Michael Jordan was the director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department for a period of time. He came in after Jane Khalifa moved upstairs to become assistant city
okay.
coordinator. Michael Jordan came in for a while. Michael Jordan is the man, Mr. Allen, who made the famous and infamous statement when under fire and under inquiry by yours truly. That we had to understand in the African-American community that there could be a project and not a single African-American could be hired or would be hired, and they would still meet their goals and their good faith efforts. That was the one of the most profound and only statements that Michael Jordan ever made. And then
he ran me up out of several meetings. You know, it was a public meeting. He says, you can't be in this meeting down at City Hall. He says, you got to go. You can't be in this.
Yeah. Said,
what are you talking about?
Well, he really came in. Well, you know, from my perspective, he really came in and dismantled the agency, you know.
Yeah.
He really came
yeah.
in and just took it apart, dismantled it, neutered it, and, you know, taking it off the board. So
and the numbers of employees have totally
he did
dropped.
His job.
Yeah, they have, I think they have now, they have like, there's 16, I think, employees that are still there from under Mr. White, there was double that number, if you will. Now it's just down to a performer. Now people are leaving. The head of their investigative unit, Ms. Toni Wilborn, left today. The day was her final day. She's going to work over in St. Paul at St. Paul Human Rights Department. Three other staffers have left in the last couple of weeks. One is leaving to go to, Mr. Allen, MnDOT. And then there's been a couple others that left. A young African-American was fired about, let's say, 3 months ago. Now, I know that the chair of the Public Safety Committee and the council president have warned Ms. Velma Corvell about the turnover, if you will, in her operation, but in that she is a direct appointee with you know, confirmation by the council of the mayor, if you will. I think Ms. Corvell feels that she is not required to respond to some of the procedural and policy concerns that have been expressed by the council. That's probably the reason, gentlemen, in the last couple of days, that rumors have begun to float around City Hall that Ms. Corvell, who, by the way, was let out as the commissioner of the Human Rights Department, see, people tend to forget that, before she came to Minneapolis, that she may not be reappointed.
Well, you know, the whole thing now is really, it's just a facade. You know, there was an old show, you know, I used to watch called Amos and Andy.
Oh, Lord. You're talking about the television version or the radio version?
The television version.
And I came up under the radio version. When they used to have white folks read the script.
I came up on the TV version. but one of the versions, one of the things had a thing where Andy, where Kingfish sold the house to Andy, and all it was the front of the house. Okay?
That's
so he walks into the front of the house. He sold a beautiful house, looked good, but then he walked in. He was in the backyard when he walked through the front door.
Right.
And so this is what they're perpetrating on us today.
That's right.
I mean, it really is. We should have a civil rights commission, and it should have some teeth. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, it needs to happen. Everybody needs to be kept in check. I mean, let's be real here. Everybody has their own agendas. Everybody has their own, okay. But we all need to come to the table, and we all need to have our own foothold in what we're doing. You know, we can't be just thrown to the wayside, but we allow ourselves to do that.
I'm afraid that's what they've done. All these entities are just non-functional. I don't even know why they go through the motion of requesting applications to serve on the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission because it doesn't do anything.
Very apropos statement, going through the motion. I don't know. I mean, I'm so just distressed about. And then what's going on with this burning of churches again? No, I thought this was all over with, and all of a sudden
This is payback. This is the extreme right sending a message. What I'm concerned about is when they bomb the next black church.
Well, I know. Yeah. I am too, because, see, a lot of innocent people, and, you know, I mean, how many, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 churches have been bombed since then? I mean, come on. These are the terrorists, okay? Forget about ISIL. Forget about going over, running over there and running about them people. Get rid of these fools right here. They're right here in our midst.
Yes. Now, you're absolutely correct, because their training camps are going full blast. Anything else, Em?
No.
But I'm glad that you brought up the presence of the, once again, carnage being directed against black churches. At this point, these are small black churches, and it's very interesting because it makes it more difficult to find, and there's less interest from the ATF. That's the Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms, who are supposed to be investigating things like that. They're small rural churches. These are rural black folks, poor folks, if you will, and et cetera, who kind of understand the lay of the county, let's say, you know, in the particular now. The fires have taken place in Tennessee, North and South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida.
Okay?
And you can just gentlemen see the pattern. See, I was a young man, and M wasn't far behind, when we watched the terror of black churches being bombed, and not only firebombed, but actually bombed and blown up, and we all know the tragic history of the poor
little
girls
down there, and those little girls down there in Birmingham.
But I'm concerned because I'm hearing intel that this is just kind of the beginning, where we're going to send a message to Negro America. They kind of cut Negro off a little bit, if you know what I mean. This gentleman is what is happening. By the way, let me make one more comment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, General Lee surrendered at Appomattox, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He surrendered. It was over then, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's the end of that story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was in 1864, 5?
1865 at Appomattox.
Appomattox.
The fact of the matter is, though, there was a great degree of generosity and humility and et cetera, because Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, all them boys should have been charged with treason.
They sure should have. They should have been
put on trial behind it.
But they ended up being presidents of colleges. They ended up being living their lives in a genteel lifestyle.
Very genteel.
Come on.
That's right.
Come on.
And no one talks about the fact that the entire conflict was one in which the acts of treason was being committed. And this is the only country on the face of the planet that has had a civil war in which this nation has glamorized the history of the traitors.
Yeah.
I mean, this all this ridiculousness about the Confederate flag, man. The Confederate flag was the flag of butchery.
Ooh.
By the way, let me say this. I'm glad you happened to raise it, Em. And, Mr. Allen, this is for our listening audience coming in.
You're getting kind of deep.
One of the things that happened in the Civil War that no one talks about, and that is our war crimes. Gentlemen, I think that both of you, remember, you can research it easily on your computers. You know, one of the things that the Confederacy bragged about, you know that Negro prisoners were not taken alive. Both of you gentlemen remember that?
Yeah. Oh, I do.
During combat,
absolutely.
One of the reasons that Negro troops fought so fiercely is that the Southerners indicated that the Negroes were not worthy of being taken as prisoner and consequently were executed.
Mm-hmm.
That was a war crime.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then somebody shows me a flag called the Battle Flag of the Confederacy, and this is my relatives and my loved ones, and they fought for principle. See, they're trying to change the real reason in the battle as it pertains to the battle between the Confederacy and the Union, as if slavery was not an issue, and this was something much more mundane and pure. Right, gentlemen?
But they lost, okay?
Yes,
they
did.
They fought the war. Okay, and I go along. You know, I hate wars. There's no
mm-hmm.
need to do that. But they fought that war and they lost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they lost. So they need to kind of get in line with what the country is about. You know, they can't continue to say, "Well, we're," and then they continue with their flag. They continue to not burning churches, and you know that has to be rooted out, and the government should do that. I mean,
by the way, maybe we don't
ISIL.
Want to use the word root anymore. Think
I'm
about
thinking
that.
About them.
We don't want to use the word root, given who's sitting in a jail right now waiting to be formally charged for the murder of 9 African-Americans in a sanctuary. Daryl Storm Root.
Well, gentlemen, I guess I'll bid adieu.
All right.
Well, until next time.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Right. Take care.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen, the phone lines are open, man. We got in a little
bit
of the Confederacy, if you will. And,
what
they used to call it, the Stars and Bars.
Caller, you're live on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Nobody's
caller, you're live on the air, ma'am.
Can't hear. Have to speak up.
Can you speak up, ma'am? She might just want to listen, so I'm going to put her back in the queue.
Oh, okay.
Edwards.
All right. Get that phone number out again. That the lines are open, man.
Phone number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. lines are wide open. Mr. Edwards, you know, we had invited the Council on Black Minnesotans chair, board chair, Mr. Patwin Lawrence, to join us to kind of give us his wrap, because I know that as of July 1st, I think that the last session,
today,
for lack of a better word, today.
Today's the first day of July in the year of our Lord, 2015. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're glad to welcome Mr. Patwin Lawrence live on the air with us, the chairman of the Council on Black Minnesotans. Mr. Lawrence, howdy, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
All right. Mr. Lawrence, first of all, just indicate to us, what is your current status, sir? I know the last time you were with us you were not reappointed, or I don't know if they got term limits or whatever. What, sir, is your current status as of this
quarter moment? I am free as a bird.
Okay.
So, so I rolled off, last night at 11:59 p.m., as well as three other board members, and which is kind of interesting because normally the governor appoints board members to the council in the month of June, and they told us that they were waiting until after the session, which I guess technically this is after the session. So at our board meeting that we had on Saturday, we were not able to have full board elections, which normally takes place according to our bylaws in the month of June. We were able to appoint an interim chair until new board members, because out of the board members that were present, which we did have a quorum, four of us were rolling off as of yesterday. So that just kind of shows you just kind of what has been going on. And I think we're the only council that had board members that were rolling off with that July 1st date with the new legislation that's supposed to, you know, go into effect. So it just shows
now, as I understand it, based on the new legislation and et cetera, now the current executive director of record, Mr. Edward McDonald, is in the process of reapplying. Are we correct?
Yes. According to the new legislation, he has to reapply for his position, as well as the directors of the Latino and Asian councils.
Okay. And was there a list, or excuse me, was there a notification posted indicating that the position was open?
Well, I don't think that they have started the process, the legislative coordinating committee. Their actual director was actually at our board meetings. Well, we actually had our retreat and board meeting on Saturday, and he was there for the entire session.
Did he participate, or was he there just to monitor you?
Great word. Yes, he. Well, we kind of included him in the conversation because instead of talking about his organization, I mean, he was there, so we included him in to, you know, to give some feedback about, you know, his thoughts.
And
about,
by the way, I must say I'm a little bit of a bigot. I assume that he is a Caucasian.
Yes, he is.
Oh, okay. Go right ahead, sir.
Yes, and so he was there to just – he said he wanted to see how the council operates and kind of what we were discussing. And, you know, we were also doing our strategic planning for the new fiscal year that we're in as of today. So, you know, he was in on that planning and was able to see that. But the last motion that I was able to make as chair of the council was to authorize Edward to seek legal remedy to the situation around the legislation, which I know is a cause of concern for some people within the state government, but I think that's what is needed, because it just doesn't make any sense that our community allows these things to continue to happen to us and not fight back. And I think
may I ask you a question on that, sir? Did the motion pass?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it passed.
Okay.
Yep, and we also support an audit of state government. That's why I made sure that I've been waiting to make those motions for a couple months now. We had to go through the process of, you know, going through the legislative session and seeing how our bills did and what kind of response we got. And so I wanted to make sure that, you know, this was noted in our minutes, as well as, you know, empowering Edward to be able to, you know, take action from, which he's planning on, from what I last understand, he's planning on taking some type of action because it personally affects him.
Yes, it does.
You know, because he has to reapply. So, so he's looking into that, and then we also have an outside organization as well, the NAACP, who, you know, they we did the press conference with them.
Press conference,
earlier,
yes, you did. Yes, a month ago.
Yes.
My colleague, Mr. Allen, was in attendance as a member of the state.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, so they're also looking into legal action. They're going to the national NAACP, which their convention is in a few days here, and in Philadelphia, and seeing what can be done in terms of bringing national in here to the state of Minnesota. Because, you know, these things have gone on too long. The legislators, they like to play games. They like to, you know, just say, oh, we're improving things for you, and not really taking and listening to the feedback from the community. And, you know, and I listened to your program since 8:30, like when you started, and none of that what I heard surprises me at all. And I think people, instead of just being tired, they need to take action. And I think we just need to go to the courts. We just need to start suing these folks and getting our day in court and taking action. I think that's the course that people need to start taking.
Let me ask you this also, sir. Were the state legislative representatives present at your meeting/retreat Saturday? And what was their role? You have, what, is it two or four? I mean, they've been loading up.
It's four.
Used to be in the old days you had two legislative representatives. How many do you have now?
Well, it's four, two representatives and two senators. None of them were present, and now under
what?
The new legislation,
oh my God, Mr. Allen,
they can vote.
Are we not shocked? They didn't show up at the retreat last meeting. Wow.
Oh no, not terrible.
Well, they haven't shown up at board meetings, so I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that they're not there at the retreat.
Why don't we do this for the purpose of historical posterity and et cetera? How many meetings have the four legislative representatives, how many meetings, Mr. Lawrence, have they attended and actually participated in meaningful dialogue?
Really none of them, except for Representative Moran, who she had poor attendance, but she did attend the most out of all of the legislators. And she just recently started attending meetings when the whole legislation was starting to, you know, build steam back in, I would say, March. That's when she started attending meetings regularly, just to see what we had to say and then take information back. And, you know, and she had a listening session actually a few weeks ago in St. Paul. And,
I remember you shared that with
Senator
Lane. That was coming, yeah.
And, yeah, with Senator Lane and also, not Senator Lane, Representative Lane and Senator Pappas. Were there, and you know, and they were sitting there and they were lying to the community, and I called them out on it, and I told them that they're sitting here lying, trying to blame it on the OLA report when that was not really the reason why they were going through all of this. They really don't like the work that the council is doing, because some of them feel that we shouldn't be doing the monitoring in terms of affirmative action and equal opportunity laws. They don't like that we're really engaging the community and getting them, you know, involved in the process. So I just really call them out. And I think community members are fed up with the way that legislators have been treating our community. This is in particular the DFL that's doing this, which makes it even more serious because our community votes for the DFL, you know, some 90%.
Oh, in the 90th percentile.
And so they treat us like, like redheaded stepchildren or something, you know, and we don't need to just sit there and take that. We need to fight back. We need to tell them what we think, and they work for us. We put them in the office. We can also take them out of office.
Right.
And I think that's another course of action that needs to be taking place over the next year or so.
Let me ask this question, Mr. Lawrence. And again, we appreciate you taking the time to be with us, approximately 20 hours after your term was actually up. Were you asked by the governor's staff or even by the legislators to do, like, some kind of exit interview as it pertains to your experience? Because you served with distinction for quite some time. And certainly you have a pretty good understanding and familiarity with how things work. Has anyone approached you and talked to you about and asked you? I mean, I know it's not a formal process. We recommended it years and years ago as it pertains to the legislation. They didn't think it was important. It wasn't, you know, colored people didn't have a lot to offer. But anyway, which is a joke that they think that. But have you been asked as a courtesy, if you will? I mean, if I, you know, my vision, gentlemen, is that given Mr. Lawrence, Chairman Lawrence's is activity and participation and issues he's brought forward, that for the purpose of history and posterity, that, you know, we'd want to, I mean, retain that, you know, have that put in some kind of capsule somewhere and et cetera. And I could not, you know, even begin to believe that if you were a Caucasian and had served on, you know, well, let's say something like the Environmental Board or, mm-hmm. or something like that, that you would not be asked to provide for posterity's sake your observations and your legacy. So have you been asked? Has anyone asked you to?
No, no one has, and I don't expect anyone to. But, you know, they already know what I think because I've been pretty adamant and pretty clear about it at board meetings and in discussions with legislators. So they pretty much know what, you know, I'm going to say to them. So I don't expect to, you know, get a phone call from them or to, you know, be reappointed.
Let me just say this, but I mean, you're your own man. I'm just a, mm-hmm. but I'm a tactician and a strategist. But I'd like to suggest this to you because, as again, I, you know, you have served with distinction and et cetera and have certainly been one of the more active and effective chairpersons that we've had. I would encourage you to talk to both of the black newspapers and indicate that you would like a tad of space to present As I Depart. You know what I mean? That would kind of be my headline, As I Depart, My Thoughts. Give it some thought, Chairman Lawrence, because I think that you've earned the right to do that. You've earned the right to indicate in your own words, talking to your community, what it is that you've observed. So I hope that you give some consideration to it.
All right, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. I think I will follow up on that.
Yes, and I certainly will back you with the spokesman recorder. And suggest to my colleagues there that this is something that is warranted. I mean, and I say it for the record, gentlemen, that I think that you have been a good chairman. I think that you have been an effective chairman under the conditions and circumstances in which, as a chairman of an entity that is created to protect and further the access of African Americans into all aspects and phases of state government, I think that you have served well, if you will. You embarked on a journey, and I think, sir, you did it with integrity and commitment. And so I say that to you personally and on the record, irrespective of what somebody may say to you that Ron Edwards said, this is what Ron Edwards is saying to you on this program tonight.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right.
Yep.
Mr. Allen, anything from your side of the right?
Well, I really appreciate Mr. Patwin Lawrence's stick-to-itiveness and through all this, because it has been up and down kind of thing with the council over there. And I'm just keeping close tabs, and I really want to see what shakes out of this and who ends up where.
Mm-hmm.
I have some suspicions, but I'm just going to, you know, watch. I'm just going to watch
mm-hmm.
and see what happens and go from there. And we'll
all
just
right.
watch it cook. But we appreciate you calling in, Chairman Lawrence, and any updates that you have or anything that, you know, pops up that we have don't know about or that you think we should know about, you know how to get in touch with me. I know how to get in touch with you, and we'll have you on the air talking about it. Okay?
All right. Sounds good.
The very best to you, sir. The very best.
All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call.
Thank you all. Have a good night. All right.
Mm-hmm. Great. You too.
I tell you, Mr. Allen,
okay.
we treat those who take up the service of our community and try to do the best they can under all circumstances, we sure treat them poorly. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
I have to say it again. That is one of the fatalities, of not
mm-hmm.
having a Black History Museum. Because,
yeah,
you see, all
true.
Previous board members and chairpersons of the Council on Black Minnesotans should have had a small corner in our Black Museum so that our
mm-hmm.
children and others who have come to, in one sense, birth and life, and others who have come here to find better conditions and et cetera, would know the history. You know, the way things are going 20 years from now, people won't even know what you're talking about when you talk about the Council on Black Minnesota.
No, not at all. Not at all. No. Not at all.
But phone lines, oh, we still got about 6 minutes, Mr. Allen, in case anybody's out there. We don't want to cut anybody off.
Yep. Phone lines are open. That number is 347-426-3904. Again, the number is 347-426-3904. With 5 minutes and 22 seconds left of the show.
Mr. Allen, question to my colleague from the right. What do you really think is the future of the Council on Black Minnesotans?
I think that they will have a committee that will not do anything, a bunch of yes people, sheeple, as I call them, and they just kind of fade out of existence. You know, it won't be as – because, you know, for 20 years, Mr. Edwards, when Mr. Lester Collins was the executive director, I mean, they virtually did nothing, and the state was just tickled pink with the Council on Black Minnesotans when
they
did
like
not –
Well, I like that, tickled pink.
Yeah.
That is a good expression, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just they the council is the best thing since sliced apples and oranges and watermelon, and then – all of a sudden, they get this new crew in there led by, you know, Patlin Lawrence and Ed McDonald, and they say, well, the law says we're supposed to do this. We're just going to do what the statute says, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there's pushback. There's more pushback from the black elected officials than anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, which is telling in itself the black DFL officials, which need to be voted out of the office. And on that note, Mr. Everett, on July 8th, Bobby Joe Champion and Jeff Hayden are having a RSVP meeting in North Minneapolis. They want to know who's coming. I'll have more details next week here, hopefully, and we'll deal with it then. I think next week, the 8th, is a Wednesday night, if I'm not mistaken. I know I'm not going to be able to go, but what's
the purpose of it? I mean, is it a listening session, and what are they listening about?
Well, I don't have much detail. I'm waiting for someone to get back with me with some intel on that, but I'm sure I will be able to update you very shortly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Well, that's great. That's really great. Probably should have had one before the legislative session in January, though. It would have been beautiful to have had one the second week in December of last year. Uh-oh. But anyway, hey, we stay on our side of the highway and et cetera. Again, Mr. Allen, in closing, just want to kind of remind our listening audience they need really be concerned with this new epidemic of arson burning down black churches in the South. That is a dangerous signal being sent to us in black America.
Yeah, I would have to agree. Definitely have to agree. So I am looking here. We have a couple people in queue, Mr. Evers, but they don't want to say anything. I'm getting some messages back here. But
well, we're happy that they're there in the queue.
Yeah,
and
we appreciate you listening.
Monitoring and et cetera. And I think we, again, had a great program, if you will. And, you know, in closing, we look forward to some of the cases that Ms. Gross and her associates have uncovered and maybe drawn out into the sunlight. Of people that went in and attempted to file complaints and et cetera, and nothing ever happened. You know what I'm saying? Well, I look forward to that. We've got some interesting cases in there. But, hey,
let my man
James Brown take us home.
Actually, you know, I had a little spin on that today, Mr. Evers. Something that we did last week. So James Brown was taking a break, he said. So we're going to go out a little bit different here. Here we go.
Oh, yeah, man. Taking me across the great divide to Hollywood.
Never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw. Been in trouble with the law since the day that.
Put your bad stuff. Bad
stuff. There you go.
James Brown singing to the hillbillies. God bless America. Good night, Mr. Allen.
Good night, Mr. Allen.